Taken aback, he had noticed an increased interest in clothes on his son's part. The boy took longer over the dressing of his hair and the tying of his neckcloth, but Erasmus had always been fastidious about his linen and careful of his appearance, and was now at a foppish age. He knew his son had been going a good deal to the Walpert house, but there was the play to account for this, and Walpert had a boy only slightly younger than Erasmus.
"I suspected nothing of it," he said. "I've been much preoccupied of late. Besides, you're secretive. You always have been so. You do not come to me with your feelings, only your decisions."
If there was reproach in this, it was mainly for himself, for his failure to notice. Nevertheless, he felt immediate compunction for it.
"Well, it is your way," he said.
"Are you displeased with me, sir?"
"No, I'm not displeased. Our natures are different in this respect. I would stop to look at something, take soundings before my course was so far set. Now I see this business is screwed to such a pitch that I could not oppose it without damage."
He saw nothing on his son's face to indicate any appreciation of this. The boy still stood braced there.
"Come, sit down," he said. "Here, by me. You keep to your purposes. That is not so bad a thing. But you are young to be married, and the girl cannot be more than 18.
"She is not yet 18, sir."
"It is young,"
Kemp said slowly. Something had changed in his tone, now that surprise had faded, giving time for a glimpse of the implications. These expanded in his mind as he looked at the level-browed, intensely serious face close to his own.
"On the other hand," he said, "your mother was barely 17 when we were married. I cannot spare you from the business," he added after a moment.
"There would be no need," Erasmus said. The interview was not proceeding as expected. He was surprised to find his father so amenable, but this last objection he had anticipated.
"The match would do good for us. The combination of the families would make a powerful force, with the town growing so fast."
Kemp nodded, as if this thought had only now occurred to him.
"That is so," he said. "The connection would be of benefit to both."
With some appearance of effort, he met his son's eyes, so like his own. "It is what you want," he said.
"I am set on her."
Kemp was silent for a long moment, looking down. Then he raised a face grown suddenly haggard.
"You have my consent," he said.
It took a further week for Erasmus to discover the right circumstances, poise and apparel for his interview with Sarah's father. It was not nerve he had to summon, he had enough of that at his command, but humility, the readiness to demean himself, as he saw it, by stating his desires and seeming to petition for their legitimacy. He would have felt this, whoever the man had been. He had felt it to some degree, even with his father. Love had not so far made him happy. His intention, the fixing of his will on the girl, he experienced as an affliction. His whole being seemed tender, painful to the slightest touch, even, at times, the touch of air itself. The impressions of his senses came as blows to his heart, strangely similar to those of loss or violation. In this vulnerable state, he experienced the burgeoning of the season like a man set on bruising himself. Never had he noted the symptoms of summer with such particularity. As he saw to the unloading of the pack trains on the waterfront, or the weighing and recording of cotton bales in the yard behind the family warehouses, he heard the cuckoos calling from the market gardens of Wallasey across the water, all regret and all promise mingled in their notes. In the wood by the lake, the bluebells came in swathes, and the ash trees emerged from winter overnight, as it seemed, and were hung with reddish, plumy flowers. He took particular care with his dress the evening of his visit. An immaculate exterior reduced the appearance of suing. He chose a suit of dark satin, short in the sleeve to show the plaited linen of his shirt cuffs, a white waistcoat and black pointed-toed shoes in the latest fashion. He had powdered his hair lightly and tied it behind with a long black ribbon, and instead of the usual short hanger, he wore his best sword with a silver chasing on the hilt.
"I love your daughter, sir,"
he heard himself saying, sitting bolt upright in his chair.
"I want to marry her."
It sounded angry, almost. He had been unable, so far, to see any reaction on the broad face before him, or in the shrewd, deliberate brown eyes which regarded him now for some moments in silence.
"Do you, sir?"
the merchant said at last. He had come from business and was still in outdoor attire. Full-skirted cotton summer coat, buff waistcoat, old-fashioned wig with a roll of curls above the ears. And she? How does she view the matter? I think she is not averse to me. Is that a way of saying there is already an understanding between you? The question was deliberately disingenuous. He knew already of the young man's interest. It had been expressed to him by Sarah herself, and he knew to what extent the girl had responded, but Erasmus's hasty manner inclined him to temporize, partly from the long habit of bargaining, partly because he'd been roused to some hostility by it. "I am asking if you have spoken together," he said rather sharply. "There is no understanding, sir," Erasmus said. "But she has given me reason to hope." Walpert considered for some moments. Though phlegmatic in manner, he was acute, particularly where it concerned him nearly. His daughter was a source of delight to him, and he treasured her deeply. There was no timidity in the bearing of the young man before him, no personal deference towards himself. This first suitor of his daughter was no doubt suffering, but it seemed from arrogance as much as love. He had known Erasmus for many years, had seen him from time to time as he grew up. It was with a feeling of surprise now that he met the dark eyes and realized that the youth had become formidable. "How old are you now, Erasmus?" he said. "I shall be 22 in December, sir." "You have spoken of this with your father, of course." "Yes, sir." Walpert permitted himself a smile. Erasmus was the only son, and he knew the extent of Kemp's ambitions for him. "And how did he take it? With a pinch of salt, I suppose, eh?" "He has given his consent." "Aye, I dare say so." Walpert was still smiling. "Why would he not? But as a distant prospect, no doubt, he will want to keep you by him some time yet." "No, sir. He has made no condition regarding the time." Erasmus had great pride of family, and as far as he had pondered his father's response, apart from his own relief at it, it had seemed to him like a condescension to the Walperts, something they ought to be pleased at. But now he saw the indulgent smile on the heavy face fade quickly, and for a space of some moments he found the older man's eyes turned upon him as they might have been on some not fully trusted associate, not unfriendly exactly, but appraising and rather cold. "How?" Walpert said in a quieter tone. "Are you saying your father has given immediate consent to the match?"
"I have said so," Erasmus returned rather brusquely.
Walpert appeared to muse for some moments, then he said, "Listen well to me, my fine young man. My daughter is not yet 18 years of age. She is too young to be saddled with promises. You may say to her what you like, and she may answer you as she pleases. I cannot be present at it, so I can have nothing to say about it. But I will countenance no special arrangements, at least for the time being. You may continue to see my daughter as you see her now, as a friend, among other friends. She will be 18 in some months. Then we shall reconsider." Rising to terminate the interview, he caught a blaze from the young man's eyes, such as might have been reserved for a rival. "I expect you to abide by this, on our words and my wishes alone," he said with an involuntary response of severity, "and I will make both known to my daughter." This he did, in gentle terms, and had an impression the girl was relieved at it. That same evening he consulted his wife, who had been aware of the situation for some considerable time, he now discovered, and who had sounded the girl in ways that would not have entered his head. Of the strength of the young man's feelings there could be no doubt. "He cannot keep his eyes off the girl," Mrs. Walpert said placidly. "He watches her every movement." Embroidery in lap, eyes mild, hair tucked under her close-fitting lace coif, she seemed at a long remove from such devouring regards, but managed nevertheless to convey an idea of them to her husband's mind. Young Kemp's feelings were written in his eyes, and what eyes they were, full of fire. There was no denying he was a handsome young man, though far from smooth-mannered, and Sarah, of course, was aware of it, looks and manners both. There was growing up a fashion for wildness.
"If it is a fashion, it cannot be so wild," Walpert said dryly. "And Sarah, with what eyes does she look at him?"
"It is bound to make an impression on a young girl to be the object of so much attention. She is very much aware of him." Mrs. Walpert paused for a short while, though without looking at her husband. "I think she is rather frightened of the young man," she said at last, though she would laugh at the notion.
"Frightened, you say? She's not easily daunted."
Walpert considered for a moment, then he said,
"If she is frightened, she cannot have much tenderness for him."
Upon this, his wife favoured him with a look of pity for his understanding, and, as usual, in response, he showed himself aggrieved.
"Why are these things kept from me?" he demanded. "Why am I always the last to learn of a thing? I wager old Andrew knows more of the business than I do. A fine thing for a man's wife and daughter to plot together to keep him in the dark."
But he kept wife and daughter and everyone else in the dark concerning the step he took next in the matter. He might or might not be obtuse, he told himself, regarding matters of the heart, but he was certainly not so where material interest was concerned, and his suspicions had been roused by Kemp's alacrity. The following afternoon he called on a man named Partridge, whom he had used once before, some years previously, on a delicate investigation into the extent of a client's credit, and whose thoroughness and discretion he had not forgotten. Partridge was accustomed to describe himself as an attorney. He had a close and cluttered office in the upper floor of a house in Limekiln Lane, invaded by the fumes of a nearby tannery, but most of his business was conducted elsewhere, in registry offices, counting houses, copying rooms, the taverns and tap houses frequented by clerks and warehousemen and the small functionaries of business houses. He belied the associations of his name, being lantern-jawed, gimlet-eyed, and scrawny, dressed in rusty black, with an ancient, dishevelled goat's-hair wig. "Remember," Walpert said, "the most absolute discretion is essential, not only as concerns the dealings between the two of us, but in all that affects Mr. Kemp. I do not want anything noised about, no suspicion attaching anywhere. People are always ready to say that when there is smoke there must be fire. Mr. Kemp is an acquaintance of many years, for whom I have considerable regard. There must be no damage to him or to his interests. All I want is the facts of his present situation." "You shall have them. Have no worry on that score, my dear sir." Partridge nodded and glanced aside through his small, smeared window at the tannery yard below, as if witnesses lay out there among the malodorous hides.
"Joshua Partridge is the soul of discretion," he said. "Discretion is his strong suit. He is noted for it, famous for it."
"Famous for discretion?
That is not the contradiction, it seems, sir. I mean, of course, among those who have honoured me with their commissions. Without that reputation, I could not continue an employment one day longer. In short," Partridge added, with one of the sudden bursts of frankness which characterised his speech, "I should be on the rubbish heap in no time."
He paused for a moment to investigate an ear for wax. Then he said,
"I shall require, in addition to the 50% advance of fee we have agreed on, a sum of 10 shillings a day while inquiries last. This is to cover all necessary expenses I may incur in the furtherance of my inquiries. In short, sir..."
Walpert was ready to pay, but it was against his ingrained habit to pay without discussion.
"That is considerably more than I remember paying the last time I had the honour to employ you, Mr. Partridge."
"Sir," Partridge said, "this is an expanding age. The nation is prospering. Our voice is heard in the councils of Europe. As a result of this, the cost of everything goes up daily, and that must also include gifts, rewards, and all manner of pecuniary inducements. Numbers of men are getting richer, and greater numbers are getting poorer. Alas, both classes have higher expectations these days."
The attorney permitted a lean smile to move his jaws.
"In short, sir," he said with a burst, "there has been a leap in bribes."
Chapter 18. Day by day the Liverpool merchant made progress southwards. Under full sail, propelled by fair winds, she dipped and rose through the heavings of the sea with a profound regularity. On the line of the horizon there would sometimes appear the brief stain of another ship, like a breath on a distant mirror, but most of the time she could feel herself alone on the ocean, the sole trader of the world, instead of what she was, a member of a vast fleet sent forth by men of enterprise and vision all over Europe, engaged in the greatest commercial venture the world had ever seen, changing the course of history, bringing death and degradation and profits on a scale hitherto undreamt of. That the ship was a mere corpuscle in this nourishing bloodstream was not easy to imagine for the men aboard her, To them, she was a universe of routine tasks and routine sounds. The bell marking the half hours, shouted orders, the wash of the waves, the wincing tune of the timbers as they were exercised by the sway of the sea. Forces less tangible but equally determinate worked on the men, and they were set in relation to one another in sympathy or antipathy, as happens in all communities. 14 days out, they began to be sensible of a change in the climate. Hughes felt it, high up at the main-to-gallant masthead, standing by to loose the sail. He was always happiest when alone and high up, past the timbers of the mastheads. Only here, apart from corners of the night-time deck, could he be sure of finding no others close by him. He climbed to solitude, hand over hand, looking up towards it, where it lived in the sky, bare feet sure in the ratlines, body moving to the sway of the ship. Most of the crew could work aloft if need be, and men like Blair, Wilson, Libby and Deacon were proficient seamen, but there was no one to match Hughes when it came to working in the tops, no one with his speed and balance and climbing. He could go from deck to cross trees quicker than men half his age, and keep nerve and footing and hand sail in storm and dark when the gale tore at him and the ship bucked like a maddened charger to throw him off. This sunny morning, leaning to brace in the yard for a free wind, the scent of the south came to him across the water. Some quality of balm had come into the air. The ship leaned to starboard, and Hughes saw dolphins swimming alongside, directly below, close to the surface. The sun struck down to them, and in their rapid motions the creatures formed and dissolved themselves, dark grey, silver and blue by turns, then shimmering and streaming into sunlight. And Hughes, who from adolescence had been unsettled by people coming too close, who had once scarred a man terribly in the hysteria of contested space, was happy to be in this clear weather, above the clouds of sails, with these rainbow bursts of dolphins following the ship. Paris, taking his paces on the after part of the deck, felt the change in latitude as a softer quality in the sky, and a gleam of pearl at times on the undulations of the sea. He saw flying fish for the first time in his life, and wrote about them in his journal. He had found unexpected solace in this daily recording of observation and impression. It had come to seem a contrivance for talking still to Ruth, telling her of things she might not know, submitting his thoughts to her, to share them, and in a way to have them judged, as he had delighted to do when they had been together. The translation of Harvey, too, he persisted with, as a focus for the mind, something in the monotony of these southward sailing days to give him a sense of choice, of independent being, some relief from the oppression of passivity which stalked his days and nights. He felt as subject to external forces as the ship was, or as the sea itself, whose every twitch was determined, whose rages and calms were equally docile. Docile, too, the vast forces that ruled her and the shores she nibbled at. Paris thought of it as a maze of concentric circles on a single plane, each continuous with the next, like a flattened spiral, with himself a speck on some interior rim. Somewhere beyond and above was that principle of harmony eloquently espoused by Mr. Pope in his Essay on Man. The couplet ran through his mind now. All discord, harmony not understood. All partial evil, universal good. The followers of this harmonizing God, in a spurt of partial evil, had killed all his hopes and ruined his life. And now, at some other rim of the maze, there were flying fish, which Ruth had never seen. They are, as far as I can judge, some 18 inches in length, with tails forked like a swallow's, but one side is shorter. They have two wings, which are not, properly speaking, wings at all, but which I take to be the fins of the breast, enlarged and shaped to this purpose of flight. It is a large question how this shaping came about. I did not observe the fishes to flap their wings, but to glide, rather. They appear to build up speed under the water, and on gaining the surface make rapid beats of the still submerged tail, and it is this which gives them the final impetus they need to rise up into the air. Once airborne thus, they are capable of performing several consecutive glides over the water, the tail propelling them up again each time they sink below the surface. These creatures are fashioned precisely to their purpose. The fashioning is open to observation, but the purpose remains obscure. Why should these fish alone, among the denizens of ocean, be equipped for flight? Can there be aspiration among fishes? A question I could put to our good captain, if only to see him struggle with the furious contempt it would cause him. If aspiration determines development, the eagle would be judged superior to the wren. It occurs to me as a legitimate question whether these flying fish could replace their fins if damaged. We now know a lizard can do so with its tail. Andrea Moore has demonstrated beyond any reasonable doubt that a crayfish can grow a new claw. These are strong arguments against a fixed creation and an unchanging order. If a crayfish can grow a new claw, why cannot a bird? If a lizard was given this particular attribute at the moment of creation, why were other creatures not given it? Paris paused. The door of his cabin was open, and from where he sat he could see the stern of the punt, which was hoisted amidships, just forward of the mainmast. It made a beaker-shaped angle with the boom on which it rested, and the beaker filled and drained with exact regularity as the ship dipped her bows and raised them. The liquid, pale cobalt in colour, was not at first associated in his mind with the sea at all. For some moments, seeing this calm filling of the beaker, he was back in his student days, at a long stained bench with others, testing for acids with litmus, holding up the glass vessel to see the obedient stain. He was distressed now at the memory. Those days were like a time before a fall. The ruin of his life lay between. How wonderful, he had thought, that suffusion of red. The memory of Wilson's flogging came suddenly to him. The start of blood across the man's back, the pattern of drops on the deck, Thurzo's expression of fulfilment. Conviction pierced Paris before he could summon any customary defence. This was not some other point in that maze of circles. He and Wilson occupied the same point. My back, my blood, me sullen in chains, me calling for help. He started away from this as from some appalling trepidation, hastily closing and stowing away his journal, and taking out, as antidote to such poisonous abasement, Harvey's treatise and the pages of his translation. After some minutes, the plain and closely argued Latin text succeeded in putting other thoughts from his mind. It had fascinated him and struck him as paradoxical from the start that this treatise, destined to change beliefs held since Galen's time and assert a new path for the blood, should still be couched in the strict form of scholastic disputation unchanged since the Middle Ages. He had got as far as Chapter 8, in which the author explains his reasons for the forming of his famous hypothesis. To restore himself, he looked at the beginning of the third paragraph, one of the most profoundly influential in the history of medicine, and marvelled once again at the miraculous tentativeness of it, almost casual, like a man working from dream to truth. Coepi egomet mecum cogitari. I began to bethink myself whether it might not have a kind of movement, as it were, in a circle. He was interrupted by the appearance at his door of McGann, a small, tight-faced Scot, one of the men who had been deloused and hosed down on the captain's orders soon after sailing. The working rig he had been issued with was too big. His canvas smock hung round him, and he wore the baggy breeches rolled up to his knees.
"Begging your pardon, Doctor," he said, removing his woollen bonnet to show a cropped head. "I have been pissing pins and needles again, and 'tis unco painful."
"I have told you why it is," Paris said, "and you knew it well enough before." Nevertheless, he was glad in a way to see the man there. His medical duties had so far been less than onerous. He had seen to the lacerations on Wilson's back. He had pulled a tooth for a man called Bryce, which had broken in some shore fight and subsequently rotted. He had dressed a burn for Morgan the cook, and given a course of mercury to McGann for his gonorrhea. It was not much, in more than 2 weeks at sea.
"You are past the worst of it," he said. "You have no venereal chancres. Your general health is not impaired."
McGann glanced up at this. His eyes were watery grey beneath sandy brows, and they possessed a kind of spurious alertness. The nature of his disease gave him no apparent disturbance. It was no more than an item in the sum of difficulties and small stratagems that his life represented.
"'It's unca painful,'
he said again.
"'No doubt it is,' Paris said. "'They talk about the pains of love, don't they? But it will pass.'
McGann made no immediate move to withdraw, but remained where he was, cap in hand, eyes lowered, as if waiting for some gift of words that he could carry away with him. Or possibly something more tangible, Paris thought. He had grown more sensitive to faces of late, and had seen in McGann's a sort of ultimate reduction to the necessities of survival. Everything possible in the way of misfortune and abuse had been endured by the small-featured, freckled face before him, with its pursed-up mouth and spurious shrewdness of expression. McGann's life seemed entirely a matter of improvisation, of seeking advantage, however small, from every occasion.
"'I don't know what you want from me,' the surgeon said. "'You're quite fit for duty. All you're now suffering from is a slight inflammatory discharge of mucus from the membrane of the urethra.'
McGann seemed impressed by this, though he kept his eyes respectfully lowered.
"'Jiminy Jig,' he said. "'I've got all that too, have I? Where is it situated?'
Billy Blair, hoisting out the punt to try the current along the Sullivan and the taciturn Wilson, felt the change too, some essence of scent dissipated by distance. He raised his blunt nose and sniffed at invisible shores.
"'We're getting south,' he said. "'Soon be up with the Canaries. I can smell them bloody pine trees and spices. Blair is the keenest nose of anyone. I can smell them African women already. I can smell the palm oil in their cunt thatches.'
It was said, as much as anything, as an attempt to deflect Sullivan from the grievance of his forcible ablution. After a fortnight at sea, any mention of cunt was likely to cause a diversion. However, on this occasion it failed to do so.
"'No,' the fiddler continued. "'Look at it however you like. To take a man and strip him and throw water over him and burn his clothes and give him clothes he never asked for and wouldn't be seen dead in and cut his hair close enough to draw blood, and all against his consent, mind you!'
Sullivan paused to take breath, gazing at Billy over the bows of the punt. His long, bony face, dark eyebrows, and bemused green eyes were more evident for the shearing away of his hair.
"'Tis a blow struck against the liberty of the subject,' he said, "'and it bears on every man aboard of this ship.' "'It doesn't bear on every man aboard of the ship,' Billy retorted. "'Every man aboard the ship is not full of bloody fleas. I aren't for one. How about you, shipmate?'
This was to Wilson, who pondered for some moments darkly, then gave it as his opinion that there were many a worse thing than fleas.
"'Well, of course there is,' Billy said impatiently. "'There's crab lice, there's rats, there's bloody lockjaw, but that is not the point I am seeking to make. That coat was rotted, and it was falling off him. It's no use him denying it.'
"'That coat could have been mended,' Sullivan said. "'That coat only needed a loving woman's hand. And another thing, that coat had 6 brass buttons on it, good as new. Where are them brass buttons now?' I'm going to ask Haynes one of these days about them buttons. I'm waiting for the right moment, and they've took it out of me pay. They've took another 3 shillings off me for this linsey-woolsey stuff I never asked for.
Well, Billy said, they've took less for you than for me.
They're taking 2 months' wages off the both of us to pay back what they spent to get us, Sullivan said.
Aye, but I'm signed for an able seaman, and you're signed for an ordinary seaman, and the difference between us is 4 shilling a month, so the bastards are taking 8 shilling more from me.
"'That's another thing that is wounding to the spirit,' Sullivan said.
"'Why should you be worth 4 shilling a month more than me? We're both men, aren't we? And I am gifted for the music.' "'Curse me,' Billy said, striking at the gunwale of the boat with the flat of his hand. "'I have seen some cuddies in my time, Sullivan, but I never saw anyone the like of you for getting hold of things the wrong bloody way. You should be glad to be losing 8 shillings less than me.'
"'We're both losing the same,' Sullivan said.
They're taking the same off the both of us. Oh, just a bloody minute.
Billy's tone was irate, but his face was beginning to wear a baffled look.
God almighty, he said. If they're taking 8 shillings more from me than they are from you, how the pox can they be taking the same from both of us?
That 8 shilling, Sullivan said patiently, that is just an idea in your head, Billy. That is the different value them miscreants have set on us. But we are both going to work 2 months for nothing and risk our lives among them heathen blacks.
Sullivan appeared at this point to lose the track of what he was saying. He was gazing forward to where two or three men, Libby among them, were sitting up against the windlass, working on some cable. In anticipation of long anchorage off the windward coast, Thurzo had ordered the cables to be rounded so as to protect them from chafing in the hawse.
"Come on, then," Billy said irritably. "Finish what you're seeing, man. Give over dreaming."
"I have finished," Sullivan said. "At the end of 2 months we have got nothing, so they have took the same from the both of us. How do you think he knew?"
"Who?"
"That miscreated mortal down there, Libby. I just remembered something he said to me about getting a new suit. He knew they were going to take me clothes off me."
"I aren't surprised," Billy said after a moment. "He is Hearn's catch fod."
"They knew each other from before," Wilson said. "They have been together on a guinea man before."
The morose and saturnine cast of his face brightened with a sudden radiant intention of violence.
"Haynes," he said. "Son of a whore, he picked the wrong cull this time. After this voyage he'll never walk straight again. I have swore it."
Unaware that he was under discussion, Libby was enjoying a joke of his own, of the kind he liked best, bringing present ridicule and future misfortune for the victim. He and a man named Tapley and the boy Charlie had been set to binding a length of the ship's cable upwards from the anchor ring to protect it from chafing. Each had taken up a section and was winding old rope strands firmly and closely about it. Callie, sent forward to join them, had come upon a length of hawser lying there waiting to be spliced. In his eagerness to do his work well and correctly, he did not notice the 2-inch difference in circumference, and set to work at once, head lowered in utmost concentration. Charlie seemed about to point out the mistake, but Libby stopped him with a quick gesture. Tapley he merely winked at. He waited until Callie was well into the work. Then he said,
"Getting on well, ain't he?"
and grinned at Tapley and the boy, both of whom he knew, with the bully's infallible instinct, to be afraid of him.
"I will make a sailor of you yet, Dan'l."
Callie smiled without looking up. His mouth hung open a little, and his blunt pink tongue protruded slightly in the unremitting attention he was giving his task. A dribble of saliva had escaped its soft crease of containment at the corner of his mouth, and made a silver thread, like a snail's track, on his chin. There was a bright shine of snot on the short slope of his upper lip. Everything exuded by Callie had a magical shine and purity about it. The beads of his sweat were like small pearls. Without saying a word to anyone, he had been filling with the pride of achievement. He tied the strands round and round, as he had seen the others do, in his big, calloused hands, keeping the tarred threads of the yarn tight and close together, making sure not to cross them or leave any gaps, the thick hemp rope lying warm and heavy across his thighs.
"You'll not only be the best man aboard at jerking off," Libby said, "you'll be the best at serving a cable. Have you seen him?" he said to Charlie. "Every night he goes out to the heads and jerks himself off, regular as clockwork. You're too busy doing it yourself to take notice, ain't you? I'm talking to you."
The boy turned his sun-freckled, undernourished face towards Libby.
"Yes," he said. "That's right."
"Too busy juicing yourself, ain't you?"
"That's right."
Libby stared at him for some moments. The frozen lids of his blind eye hung a little open, showing an ambivalent gleam.
"Pity to waste it," he said.
"Waste what?"
Deacon had approached soundlessly on bare feet.
"Give us a bit of cable," he said, making to get between Callie and Tapley. "Haynes sent me to give a hand."
"What the jig do you think you're doing there?"
he said to Callie.
"Dan'l was serving cable, and he's doing well. We're proud of him."
Libby gave his droll wink, the dead eye briefly doing duty for the living one.
"Now, don't you go spoiling his concentration. That wouldn't be right."
Deacon said quietly, "Dan'l, look up a minute, will you? Don't you see? You're working on a loose piece of hawser, not on the anchor cable. You're wasting your time, and if someone comes and catches you at it, you'll get in trouble. Who told you to bind it there?"
"One of them," Callie pointed at the others. "They said do it here."
"Stab me if we tell the halfwit anything at all," Libby said. "Why are you interfering?"
"You will have to unpick it," Deacon said. "Then you come further down here, and I'll show you how to do the worming on the cable, and then the binding."
"I don't want to unpick it," Callie said. "I've done it right."
"You have done it right as far as the work goes, but you've done it on the wrong rope. That piece doesn't need chafing gear on it." Callie looked down at the rope in his lap, then up at the grinning Libby. Some sort of suspicion was beginning to dawn in his eyes. "You should have told them," Deacon said to Tapley and Charlie. He did not look at Libby. "Men on a ship should stick together. Don't make any difference what kind of ship she is."
"We have got a preacher here," Libby said.
His mood was turning ugly. The joke had misfired, and he felt his authority was being undermined.
"You don't stick," he said. "You run."
Deacon looked at him without expression. Someone had talked then. "You think I would run from you?" he said. "You're big, but your bollocks hang by a string, same as anyone else's."
"You shitsack," Libby said. "I will spill you out."
At this threat to his befriender, something mad looked out of Callie's eyes.
"No, you won't," he said,
with astounding speed and agility. Before Libby had so much as registered the threat, he had come from a sitting position onto his haunches, had his left hand planted on the deck to take his weight, and his right clenched and drawn back. Leaning sharply forward, Deacon was in time to catch at his shoulder.
"They will flog you if you start a fight here," he said.
He kept his grip, feeling after some moments the muscles of Callie's arm relax.
"He is not worth getting a flogging for," he said more quietly.
Callie, in the red mist of rage, felt the hand on his shoulder and knew the touch. This was Deacon, who had spoken words of comfort to him and touched him in the darkness of the hulk.
"Deacon is not a shitsack," he said.
Feelings of loneliness and distress had accompanied Callie since the first day out.
Barton had proved a false friend, giving him nothing but abuse and kicks once he was on board. The vision of Africa and the hot, lewd women had faded now. It was lame Kate from the tap house that he mostly thought of at night, when he crept to some deserted corner of the deck and rubbed himself for comfort in the dark and whimpered with brief pleasure. Now he smiled as he glanced up, and the traces of his rage shone with pristine glory on the smooth skin below his eyes.
"Deacon is my friend," he said.
Chapter 19.
"Hagseed, hence! Fetch us in fuel and be quick to answer other business. Shrugs thou, malice, if thou neglectest or dost unwillingly what I command, I'll wreck thee."
"No, no, Prospero, no, no, egad, pray allow me, I really must interpose."
The director spoke with customary languidness, but his words were enough to bring the headlong wizard to a halt. Though swollen with pent speech and frothing slightly, they were rehearsing in the library, the weather having turned rainy.
"No, no, you see," the director said, "you are in too much haste. You absolutely must give Caliban time to do a proper shrug. It serves no purpose to ask him if he is shrugging and menacing him with cramps before you have allowed him the time to do it."
His name was Henry Adams, a well-known one on the London stage, as Charles Wolpert had assured them all. He was a sallow, long-shanked man with fine eyes and bad teeth and a fashionable limpness of manner.
"It is what I keep telling you, Bulstrode," the curate said. "It is what I have often complained of. I must be given time to perform my shrugging."
His face was pale, as always, in the stress of these rehearsals, and his fair, fine-spun hair showed the usual startlement.
"Why, sir, as to that," Adams said, "if you will permit me, you are not performing a suitable kind of shrug for a monster. You are drawing yourself too much upright. You are making Caliban too damnable proud."
"But, sir, excuse me, that is exactly why I do it in that way," the curate said excitedly. "I see Caliban as a proud and rebellious character."
"There is only one way to see Caliban, Reverend Sir," Adams said without heat, "and that is my way, so long as I am directing the play. I want a more abject shrug, like this."
He crouched slightly, half-turned his body, and made a long, writhing motion which seemed to start at his thin knees.
"A touch more sinuous, my good sir," he sighed. "Try it once again."
Standing alone in the corner of the big bay window, Erasmus observed this demonstration with wondering distaste. that a man should speak in his own voice one minute and someone else's the next, that he should slip so easily into mime and alien gesture, struck him as bordering on the obscene. There were other things, too, about the new director that he disliked, quite a number. The exaggerated cut of his coat, the tightness of his trousers, the rouge on his cheeks, the pimple painted black to make a beauty spot, the languid manner, the airs of a town man among provincials, the less than pristine cleanliness of the lace at his cuffs. But these were minor irritants, which, under normal circumstances, would have done no more than confirm Erasmus and his prejudices. What roused his rage was Adam's freedom with his hands. A man of the theatre to his fingertips, Charles Walpert had called him. These, along with the fingers that went with them, were all too frequently laid on the persons of the female players, particularly Miranda's, or so it seemed to Erasmus. And, most distressing of all, Miranda showed little sign of resenting the freedom. She was there now, beautiful in pale blue taffeta, but she had no eyes for him. She was waiting for her scene. "Exeunt, Prospero and Caliban, shoo, shoo, off you go. Don't overdo that over-the-shoulder snarling, Mr. Parker, if you please. Caliban is daunted, he should cower more. Now, we have the scene with the sisters. Come forward, Dorinda. Could I prevail upon you to abandon the window for a while, my dear young sir? They must look out that way while they talk of the ship. Thank you. Now, Dorinda." Dorinda was being played by the daughter of a neighbouring squire. She was a rather heavy-faced girl, but of good complexion, enhanced now by the excitement of performance. "Oh, sister," she exclaimed, moving towards Miranda with a rustle of skirts, "what have I beheld?" "What is it moves you so?" Miranda asked, and Erasmus felt his heart lurch at the sweet inquiry of her voice. Dorinda gathered herself, gestured towards the window, took a breath, and began. "From yonder rock, as I my eyes cast down upon the seas, the whistling winds blew rudely on my face, and the waves roared. At first I thought the war had been between themselves, but straight I spied a huge, great creature." Miranda waited a moment or two, then uttered the short line Erasmus knew she hated most in the play and found most difficult. "Oh, you mean the ship?" It always sounded so flat, coming after Dorinda's vivacious description.
"Is't not a creature, then?"
Dorinda widened her eyes.
"It seemed alive."
"No, ladies, no,"
Adams minced forward between them.
"I swear," he said, "one might suppose you were talking in your sleep. Rot me, if I tell a lie, you will cease altogether from petrifaction if you do not impassion your good selves more. There is Mr. Bulstrode, who gallops too much, and you two sisters were far too stately, my dears."
He took Dorinda by the hand and led her back into the centre of the room.
"Dorinda should look raptly towards the sea while she is making her speech. She has never beheld a ship before. She has no idea what it is. She is lost in amazement. On the word creature, Miranda counts three to herself. One, two, three, then turns. So."
Here he set a hand at either side of Miranda's waist and half-turned her.
"You know it is a ship, my dear, because Prospero has told you so. This is a little moment of triumph for you, and that is comic, is it not? It is a ludicrous descent from Dorinda's high-flown description. That is the way to save the line. Point up the comedy of it."
With rising fury, Erasmus saw that Adams kept his hands on the slender stem of Miranda's waist for an appreciable time after she was in the right position, and that he moved them just a fraction up and down. Her face looked absorbed, but there was a small flame of consciousness in her cheeks.
"Of course," Adams said to the cast at large, "they are also talking about men. Neither of them has seen a man before, other than Prospero. Caliban does not count as a man, being a creature of a lower order." "I dispute that, sir,"
the curate said.
"You may dispute it, sir, till you are blue in the face. If we go by the indications of the play, these two charmers have never clapped eyes on a man before, never flirted, never known the sweets of love. That is the brilliant new feature of the piece, as Davenant has given it to us. He has taken the original, not generally regarded by our cognoscenti now as more than indifferent good, and he has brought it to the point of genius by introducing a sister
for Miranda, and bringing in Hippolyto as a counterpart to Ferdinand, he's given us two couples to play out the comedy instead of just one, so you get all the complications of jealousy among them.
All the complications of jealousy, aye, there it is, Bulstrode repeated, nodding his head.
He had become very sycophantic towards the director, and often repeated his words.
Twice two is four, he said. They have doubled the comedy.
Egad, Adams said. I have seen Mrs. Belmont do Miranda to a miracle. That turn of the head and swirl of her skirts, you know, and that sly look at the audience. These two innocents know a deal more than they are supposed to. The thing is full of double meanings. It is all brilliantly paradoxical. It is a play exactly suited to the age, full of raillery and sensibility and refined manners. Mrs. Belmont is shortly to appear in a trifle of mine. He had looked rather deeply into Miranda's eyes as he spoke of the play's ambiguities, or so at least the feverish Erasmus fancied, and not much later he was making remarks about Ferdinand that added insult to injury. "Lord, love me," he said. "You're supposed to be charmed by wandering airs. Bemused, yes, bewildered, perhaps, but not, my dear friend, as if struck by a butcher's axe." As this was not said to him personally, but in his character of Ferdinand, there was nothing Erasmus could reply, resent it as he may, and the words had a spiteful aptness that made several laugh, the tutor with sycophantic loudness. Miranda did not laugh, but she looked vexed, which Erasmus thought almost worse. Later, for no good reason that Erasmus could see, Adams placed a hand in the small of her back, in the elegant concavity just above her bustle, and kept it there for at least 15 seconds while he spoke quite close to her ear. It was at this moment that Erasmus, smarting with humiliation and furious with jealousy, formed his intention to depose Adams and ruin the proceedings. Though hardly at first so definite as this to his mind, he saw soon enough that the thing brooked no delay. He knew that he was living on borrowed time. From the first, the director had regarded him as an unmitigated disaster in his role of Ferdinand. He now suspected that Adams had designs on Miranda. With both these factors combining, it was only a question of time before he was put out of the play altogether, and someone else brought in to look into her eyes and declare his love, perhaps even Adams himself. The idea was intolerable. The very thought of it made him flush and clench his fists. He thought of sounding the rest of the cast for support, attempting to incite a mutiny among them, but he was not sure of finding immediate support, and there was no time for persuasion, even if his pride had allowed it. No, he would have to act alone. Intimately joined with these thoughts was the pain of Miranda's complacence. As the last days of June passed into the 1st of July, and the open land around the town was deepened and made vivid by the colours of the young corn, he struggled to understand why she showed no repugnance, why her face had no shadow on it when that posturing jackanapes issued his vinous breath close beside her, made his insinuations, put his reprobate hands upon her. Finally, in order to bind himself and guarantee success, he translated his intentions into a solemn vow. He had carried from childhood the belief that if one promises hard enough, anything can be brought about. At home, in the silence of his room, in the midst of objects sanctified by familiarity, a pair of silver cockspurs, a framed embroidery of the 8th Beatitude, done by his mother in blue and white, the silver-mounted duelling pistols that had been a present from his father, his washing-basin and matching jug with a design of daisies, before these silent witnesses he uttered aloud his vow to put paid to the director, even if it meant wrecking the play. After this, he felt, it could only be a matter of tactics.
Chapter 20. At the beginning of July, the ship came into hazy weather with light falls of rain in the night and a small northern swell. At sunrise, on the morning of the 2nd, Thurzo took an observation of the amplitude and was surprised to the extent of compass error. It was customary to allow no more than a half point of deviation in these waters. He began to suspect that he was on a course eastward of the Grand Canaries, but found it difficult to believe that he could be so far out in his reckoning on a relatively short run, and in this continual fine weather. some degree of uncertainty he was long accustomed to, navigation being a chancy business at this time. Latitude could be known with reasonable accuracy by measuring the height of the sun at noon, but to establish longitude, Thurzo had to depend for direction on his compass, and for distance travelled on the log, a small board drawn astern by which the ship's speed could be measured. This was not an accurate instrument, allowance having always to be made for drifting to leeward, and for the action of currents, so the reckoning was frequently wrong. It was seldom that the master of a ship at sea knew exactly where he was. But the error here was greater than usual. It began to seem to Thurzo now that they had come between Madeira and Port Santo, though without seeing either. If that was so, he was a good 50 leagues eastward of his reckoning. The suspicion troubled Thurzo and darkened his mood. He sat alone in his cabin with a bottle of brandy, brooding on the malignant current that had carried them thus far out, seeking to understand whence it had come and to guess what offence on the ship had set it in motion. "Another man flogged today," Paris was writing in his journal some hours later. "This for fouling his bedding after due warning by Haynes, the boatswain, who I believe is generally hated. Thomas True, the man's name. He was given a dozen lashes by our accomplished captain, and, unlike Wilson, cried out almost from the beginning. When it was over, he was not able to stand unsupported. That such cruel punishment can overcome ingrained habits of uncleanliness, or perhaps symptoms of some deeper disorder of mind, I do not believe. Indeed, it seems too savage a question even to speculate upon, and it is one, in any event, I could not pursue with anyone on board the vessel, my position as an officer of the ship preventing frank speech among us. I went forward to do what I could for True's lacerations. I have also lately treated a member of the crew named Kavanagh for an inflamed condition of the eyelids, which I suspect is venereal. I got it from True that he came as a youth to Liverpool to better his condition, as he says, after working from the age of 10 in a stone quarry in North Wales. Having spent what money he had, he was given credit by a tavern keeper, and afterwards threatened with the magistrates unless he signed on for a slaver. He was also obliged, in the event of his death, to bequeath his wages for the trip to this same tavern keeper. Since then he has been on several slave ships. He says he would not choose a guineaman, notwithstanding the higher wages. It appears the men get 2 shillings a month above the normal rate as an inducement. This does not seem much to me in view of the bad conditions on these ships and the dangers of disease on the Guinea coast. But the fact is, they cannot choose. All these men are driven by the direst poverty. I do not think there is one of them who would not quit the sea tomorrow if they could, except perhaps Hughes, who is savagely misanthropic and seems happiest when up in the rigging alone. He too has been on slave ships before, or so I think. It seems to me there is a difference in the aura they carry about them between these men who have sailed on Guinea ships before and those who are new to it, however inexperienced they may be as seamen. I would be hard put to describe this difference. They are rough and reckless men, almost all, yet I feel that it exists, and is indeed one of the elements determining the constitution of this floating commonwealth. Some are always alone, like Hughes, and a man called Evans, who never speaks, but most have made alliances of one sort or another. The strong have their satellites, who also have theirs, in a chain of being like the order of creation, which, we are told, governs the universe. Haynes has Libby for attendant, and Libby, a man named Tapley, a most unpleasant, vicious fellow to all appearance, who in his turn lords it over poor Charlie, the cabin boy. At the apex there is Captain Thurzo, with Barton as his messenger and voice, and Thurzo carries a passenger nobody sees but himself, a kind of divine supercargo who relays messages from some more abstract deity, some wielder of wind and current. I am growing convinced that our captain interprets the universe as a system of signals addressed to himself, which is what many do who end in bedlam. But he has this world of the ship to govern. He has people to judge and punish. He can force the shape of things to suit his sickness. How many of our governors and judges would end poor frothing bedlamites without this resource, I wonder? And perhaps it is natural so to force the world, if one has the power to do so. We know so little of it in any case. We are so little skilled at reading the evidence. We see appearance only. Then, if we are in a dream, why not be our own interpreters, like Thurzo, and turn madness
to good account.
Paris paused and laid down his pen. Perhaps it was wrong to think of systems, to seek coherent principle in this random human community of the ship. The words of his revered Maupertuis came back to him. One constructs for oneself a satisfactory system only when one is ignorant of the characteristics of the phenomena to be explained. What was one left with, then, but isolated phenomena, fast losing distinctness, the look in a man's eyes, the start of blood on the pale skin, the patter of drops on the deck? So to what end do I pass distractedly from observation to speculation to some wild call to take on sufferings not my own? I have enough with my own. As if in the duress of a dream it came to him again, my blood, my pain. And now, clamouring for inclusion, there was Thomas True, who soiled his bedding and was flogged for it, and Kavanagh, with his confiding air and the putrid discharge of his eyes. It was with a sense of fleeing that he rose, passed out of his cramped cabin, and mounted until he could see the rail of the quarter-deck and the dark figure of the helmsman beyond, and a scattering of stars. He became aware again of the ploughing ship, the endless complaint of the timbers. With this, the familiar sense of unreality descended on him. He was adrift among strangers, set on no purpose that he could call his own, and yet they were not strangers. Like him, they were captives here. Fellow captives can never be strangers, though one knows nothing of them but this. It was one of the lessons of his prison days. As he stood there, he heard 8 bells sounding, signalling the end of the watch. Mounting to the deck, he saw a figure he thought was Barton come down the ladder and disappear below. 2 or 3 men stood talking in low tones at the forecastle, having just come off the watch. It was time for him to present himself in the small stateroom adjoining the captain's cabin, where, in company with Barton and Thurzo, when the business of the ship allowed it, he was accustomed to take his evening meal. He found the 2 men at table already, presenting the attitudes that in the course of these weeks at sea had come to seem heraldic to Paris. The one, heavy-set and fearsomely immobile, with a face the colour of dark brick and eyes that looked always furious at not being able to burrow further in, and the other, servile, watchful and jaunty, with a habit of raising his narrow face as if sniffing.
"Well, sir," Thurzo said, "I believe you had a busy day."
Paris saw a faint grin come to Barton's face, just enough to show the edges of his sharp upper teeth. It was a regular joke with both captain and mate that his days were not much occupied, but in this present remark he thought there was a hint at his ministrations to the man who had been flogged.
"I do what comes in my way," he said. "Aye, do you? More will come in your way yet."
Paris made no immediate reply to this, and so was saved from having to reply at all, as Charlie entered at this moment with a tray from the galley. Morgan had that day killed one of the pullets they had brought on board with them, and boiled it with onions and black pepper, his invariable way with a winged creature. It lay glistening on its platter now, flanked by a mash of turnip and potato, and a jug of oily gravy of Morgan's own devising. Charlie, who had been promised some of the soup, was bearing himself and the food with some ceremony until Thurzo growled at him to look sharp, which put him in such sudden fear that he set the tray down too hard and spilled a little of the gravy, for which he was sworn at by Barton and threatened with a caning.
"Aye, aye, the boy's a born fool, let him go," Thurzo said with surprising mildness. "Mr. Barton, be good enough to carve the bird for us." "Why the fatted calf?"
Paris asked, risking a note of levity. He knew the captain's moods by this time, and sensed an air almost of jocularity about him, though the small eyes still ranged over objects as if searching for the cause of what made them less than satisfactory.
"Is there something to celebrate?" he said.
The mate, having carved and served with remarkable dexterity, had a mouth now bulging with chicken and mash, and a fork, freighted with more of it, already moving upward. He was a neat and voracious eater.
"Explain the situation, Mr. Barton," Thurzo said in his hoarse monotone.
Barton lowered his fork with visible reluctance. "This will be our last evening for supper in here, till we have our full complement of courgettes and are underway for Jamaica. We're to have the samples hoisted in here tomorrow and laid out."
"Samples?" Paris had still not understood.
"It's not going to place out,"
Barton said indistinctly. He had resumed eating while Paris hesitated.
"We're approaching Africa, Mr. Paris," Thurzo said. Within 10 days or so, I expect to be sighting Sierra Leone. This room will be our showplace, our shop, sir. The cabaciers who come aboard with slaves for sale will be able to see a selection of our goods. It is important they get a fair view of what we are carrying. The Negro is appealed to through his eyes, Mr. Paris. I know these people. I was dealing for slaves before you were born.
Their eyes caught by shine and shimmer, Barton said, pausing to wipe his mouth with the back of his hand.